It is Monday, January the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Turkish commandos moving into Afrin in Syria in a pursuit of Kurdish militia.
I know the area very well. It's mountainous terrain that runs across the border into Turkey and then down to the sea near the ports of Iskenderun and Mersin.
Also ahead, deadly Taliban attack on a Kabul hotel.
The security situation in Kabul is not improving. It's deteriorating continuously, especially if you take this, the location of this particular hotel.
There's a U.S. government shutdown, plus the sounds of the spinners. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey's army and rebel allies are battling a Kurdish militia in Syria's Afrin province, stepping up a two-day-old campaign against YPG fighters, which Ankara accuses of ties with the insurgency being carried out by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. VOA's Victor Beatty asked former U.S. Ambassador to Turkey, James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, is this a new front in Syria's 7-year civil war?
It's not a new front because, the main conflict on the ground in Syria has been between the Syrian opposition and Assad, Iran, and Russia, with the U.S. and Turkey and the Arab states at various points more or less supporting the opposition. Then the second front was, of course, the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS, which occasionally the Russians and Assad and Iran would join in on. The ISIS campaign is pretty much finished, but now the United States is moving in a different direction to try to contain Iran. That was the point of Rex Tillerson's speech back on Wednesday of this week. The problem is the Turks have a real security concern with the YPG, and we haven't sorted that out yet. Not so much where the Turks are going in now, but in the area where we have American forces in the northeast of the country.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis on Sunday on a trip to Asia said that the U.S. was notified by Turkey ahead of the airstrikes in Syria. But again, the story says they're U.S.-backed Kurdish militia, and you're saying that's not the case.
No. The U.S. is very clear in the statement it put out today, the State Department, that the U.S. has not been supporting these people. It's urging caution on all sides and restraint on all sides. But the U.S. made it very clear at several points that it is not, if you will, on the ground with these people. These people have not been part of our fight against ISIS.
Mattis, in his comments, said Turkey has legitimate security concerns.
And he's right.
And that has to do with these sporadic attacks into Turkish territory?
Right. And they particularly have come from the Afrin area. I know that area very well. It's mountainous terrain that runs across the border into Turkey and then down to the sea near the ports of Iskenderun and Mersin. And that has been a route that the PKK, this Turkish insurgent group of which the PYD is a Syrian offshoot, has been able to infiltrate and attack Turkish forces repeatedly in that area.
Is there an indication how long this operation will last?
The active operation, probably not that long, because, as I said, I think they're going to try to set up a buffer zone. But then Turkish troops will remain on there. Turkish troops are on the ground in other areas of Syria, too. Much of Syria is being held by either Turkish troops and their local allies or the United States and our local allies.
Russia has blamed the U.S. for Turkish action.
Right, but that's just propaganda. It can be easily dismissed.
And as Ambassador James Jeffrey, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Also in the news, in Afghanistan, gunmen in army uniforms who stormed Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel late on Saturday and battled Afghan special forces through the night, killed dozens, wounded many more. The final death toll and wounded may still go higher. We asked Indiana University scholar Nazif Sirani, a native of Afghanistan, for his take on this attack.
Well, it simply tells us that the security situation in Kabul is not improving. It's deteriorating continuously, especially if you take the location of this particular hotel, sort of strides top of a hill looking on western Kabul on one side and eastern Kabul on the other, and it only has one single access road to the hotel. And I was in Kabul this summer, in fact, visited it. The security situation seemed extremely strict for people gaining any access to the hotel. There were at least 2-3 checkpoints from the main road once you turn towards the hotel. But one thing that's curious is the switching of the security apparatus. When I went, it clearly was government personnel, whether they were police or army. They belong to the government forces. Apparently, the reports also indicate that some private company was given the job of securing the hotel. And security organizations like this are always owned by some government official, some high-ranking government official. And they are, of course, for purchase. And that may have something to do with that, but we'll have to wait and see what role that may have played. But it is clear that without some kind of insider, either within the hotel staff or security personnel or some kind of government connection, it would be extremely difficult to get into the hotel, especially with heavy weapons, not just light weapons, but apparently they had some heavy weapon taken into the hotel.
Taliban claims it sent five suicide bombers into the Intercontinental Hotel. All five were killed. We asked Dr. Shirani if the Taliban is stepping up its campaign in Afghanistan.
They obviously are on the offensive. I mean, the same reports talks about having killed 30 or so police in Balkh province and also in Farah, all over the country. I mean, there's no safe place. Any news from Afghanistan any day that you watch, and I do watch them, via computers and so forth, it's the same story, that they are active everywhere in the country, and they seem to be, they get killed, but they're obviously suicide attackers. But they also make the point that the government is not in charge.
Nazif Shirani is a professor at Indiana University, Bloomington. The Taliban, by the way, which refers to itself as the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, is a Sunni Islamic fundamentalist political movement in Afghanistan currently waging war within that country. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. A U.S. government shutdown amid a congressional dispute over spending and immigration has forced scores of federal agencies and outposts to close their doors, and it's triggered furloughs to some government civilian workers. The immigration issue, for instance, is mainly focused on the so-called DACA program set up during the Obama administration to help the hundreds of thousands of immigrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally by their parents. They were children when they were brought here. Lawmakers said Sunday there will be a Monday midday vote on extending the U.S. government federal budget, but so far there are no indications leaders of either party or the White House are ready to compromise on their positions. VOA's Lori London talks to Michael Ezra. He is professor of American Multicultural Studies at Sonoma State University in California.
I think the Democrats hold the cards because not only do they have the policies upper hand, but also the politics upper hand. They are in favor of the Dreamers having a clean bill, but so are most Americans. So Republicans are tied in knots here. The so-called Trump base would be very much against the Dreamers getting amnesty, but the overwhelming majority of the country, including Republicans, voters do want them to get citizenship and amnesty.
It would appear that there is an element of the nation and an element of the president's staff that have somewhat of an anti-immigrant sentiment. We heard about the so-called comments in the Oval Office, and I think that a lot of people are blaming those comments that the president made or is accused of making on this being stalled out. Would you agree with that?
Well, what a dilemma the president has gotten himself into. He runs on the idea that Mexican immigrants are rapists and bad for America and that we're going to build a wall. And the whole running of the government now depends on him having to back an extremely popular plan to make citizens out of the children of these so-called rapists. Trump's appeal to European immigrants coming here to the United States, it's more a reflection of when he was born and the history he learned as a kid rather than the reality of the law. Immigration law was changed in 1965 in a way that facilitated immigration from Asia and Latin America and Mexico. And that's where the overwhelming majority of our immigrants come from to this day. In the first half of the 20th century, you had the majority of immigrants coming from Europe. In the second half of the 20th century, and definitely in the 21st century, you have 80-90% coming from non-European countries. And so Trump's cornered in terms of his position on immigration. There's not any kind of supply of European immigrants to make his vision happen of a mass racial reboot of the immigrant population of the United States.
What do you think is stirring all of the anti-immigrant sentiment?
Well, it's a longstanding part of American life, the duality of people's experience with immigration. I also think race is at the middle of it for many people, the changes in the racial dynamics of immigration. And there's a lot of myths about immigration that are simply not true. Immigrants drive down wages. Immigrants are taking jobs that hardworking Americans would otherwise do and get paid better for. So immigrants are convenient scapegoats, and immigrants can be exploited and profited off.
You mentioned that you don't see how any way the Democrats could be blamed for this, but the Republicans are blaming the Democrats, saying it's entirely their fault, and they're going to probably use that line regardless. So is it possible that it's just both sides' fault?
The bases will always blame the other side. So it comes down to that number of swing voters or independent voters, which we don't really know how large is. But some of the poll data that I've seen has shown that there is a tsunami coming, basically a backlash to Trump in the next election that is unprecedented. So I don't think that the independent voter is going to see this as a both sides take the blame thing. Republicans will blame Democrats and Democrats will blame Republicans, but independents will blame Republicans, and particularly Trump. And the hole therein just is getting deeper and deeper and deeper.
That is Michael Ezra. He's a professor of American Multicultural Studies at Sonoma State University, and he was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. On day one of the U.S. government shutdown, Saturday, which occurred on the first anniversary of President Trump's inauguration, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators gathered in cities across the U.S. and around the world, for that matter, to call for equal rights and pay and health care for women, to denounce sexual harassment, and to encourage women to run for political office. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports.
Under a clear sky and unusually warm January weather, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators clogged the city streets of Chicago to send a message.
The message of this protest this year is to get everyone out there to vote and to make sure that we can get the right people in the right seats in the House and the Senate to make sure the vote is equal and to help everyone get to the point where we're not constantly fighting against each other.
Chloe Ramjohn participated in the March to the Polls demonstration on the one-year anniversary of President Donald Trump's inauguration.
I don't think it's necessarily a protest against Trump himself. I think it's the government in general. You know, they're not recognizing and paying attention to what's happening. Trump is the face of the government right now.
New York City is representing.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio told reporters covering his city's event that President Trump should take note of the size of the crowds and the message of the marchers.
The president's going to have to listen. When you see this kind of grassroots outpouring, it means a lot. And you're certainly going to see more of it throughout this year. Anyone who thinks it was a one-hit wonder is wrong. That what happened a year ago was the beginning of a bigger movement.
Right now, this was the movement. It had to happen. And unfortunately, our current president, he pushed us there.
Vanjie Williams isn't just marching in the nation's capital. She's a candidate for U.S. Congress in Virginia, part of a record number of women who are seeking office in the 2018 congressional midterm elections.
It's now time for women to step up and take their seat at the table.
And I feel like a lot of people get the wrong idea about what this march is for, and I feel like we're really just fighting for gender equality.
A fight that Chicago demonstrator Ali Sayasan hopes will translate into votes.
Everyone registered to vote?
Ultimately change later this year.
The future's female, and they can't keep oppressing us because we'll fight back.
While some crowd sizes were down from last year, there was no shortage of energy and enthusiasm among the demonstrators.
This is what America looks like.
Who hope their march is more than just a protest, but a sustained movement that brings lasting change and unity to a divided country.
This is what democracy looks like.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of the great American R&B sensations, The Spinners. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In many parts of the world, it's the peak of the influenza or flu season. Doctors say you can get this potentially deadly viral illness by being exposed to droplets transmitted through the air by an infected person's coughs or sneezes, or by touching surfaces contaminated with the virus. A new study led by researchers at the University of Maryland suggests that it's much easier to pass along the flu than thought. Their study outlines evidence that the influenza virus can be spread by just the breath of an infected person. In other words, you can get the flu by just breathing the same air as someone who has the virus. The authors of the study say that their findings could help reduce the impact of influenza epidemics and pandemics. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music. The Spinners are an American rhythm and blues group that formed in the U.S. city of Detroit, Michigan in 1954. They had tons of hits throughout the 1960s and 70s, like Rubber Band Man. And even today, the group continues to tour with Henry Fambrough, the only original member of the group, which also included Billy Henderson, Purvis Jackson, C.P. Spencer, and James Edwards. In 2015, the Spinners were nominated for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and over the decades, they became the soundtrack for people dating, falling in love, and deciding to spend their lives together. Could It Be I'm Falling in Love was a major part of that soundtrack. After their years on the Billboard charts had ended, the Spinners continued touring for decades. They're still big draws on the oldies and nostalgia concert circuits, playing the music that made them famous. Out on the road, their hit Then Came You, a duet with R&B pop sensation Dionne Warwick, always is on the playlist.
Since I met you, seems I can't forget you. The thought of you keeps running through the back of my mind. Every time I'm near you, I get that urge to feel you. Just touching you and loving you makes everything right.
You know, that song combines two of my favorites from my younger years. Dionne Warwick, The Spinners, doesn't get any better. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Up next, the latest world news. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Dionne Warwick and the Spinners.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
In a bid to protect the rights of citizens, the founders of the United States included in the Constitution, the legal framework of the new government, 10 amendments, 3 to protect individual rights and 7 to ensure justice. They are collectively named the Bill of Rights. The Fifth Amendment defines constitutional limits on the government's prosecution of persons accused of crimes. The amendment's first clause requires that one may not be tried for a serious crime unless he or she is first indicted by a grand jury. The grand jury, an old common law English institution, acted as a sort of filter, protecting the accused from unreasonable or punitive prosecutions by the English monarchy. The framers of the Constitution chose to retain the grand jury system to protect the accused from overzealous prosecution by the central government. The second clause protects the accused from repeated trials for the same offense, so-called double jeopardy. This means that once an individual is found to be innocent of a crime, he or she cannot be harassed through the courts by multiple prosecutions for the same alleged offense. The third clause protects the accused from being forced to testify against him or herself in criminal cases. During trial, a witness may plead the Fifth Amendment, thus declining to answer questions where the answers might incriminate him or her. The fourth, or due process clause, guarantees fair treatment through the judicial system for all persons. It requires the government to respect all rights, guarantees, and protections afforded by the Constitution and all applicable laws before the government can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Finally, the Just Compensation Clause declares that although the federal government does have the right to take private property for public use, it must pay the owner of that property fair market value at the time of the taking. The Fifth Amendment prevents excesses of the courts, something that many of the Constitution's framers had witnessed under British rule. It prevents forcing the accused into self-incrimination through intimidation and guarantees fair treatment by the courts. In the words of mid-20th century Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, the Fifth Amendment is an old friend and a good friend, one of the great landmarks in men's struggle to be free of tyranny, to be decent and civilized.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.